Hello, everybody, and welcome to this very special event that I'm doing, which is a conversation with my great friend, colleague, and co-visionary, Terry Patton, about his new book, A New Republic of the Heart, An Ethos for Revolutionaries. I'm really delighted to be here having this conversation with Terry. He has been working on this book for a very long time, really pouring his heart and soul into it. And I wanted to have this, you know, this is not something I do all the time, but I wanted to have this conversation with Terry and really share him with you and invite you into the conversation to reflect on this with us, because I feel that what Terry's talking about is and writing about so passionately and with so much depth and clarity and vision is something that is important for all of us right now. And as we get into this, I think you'll get a sense of why. So before I tell you more about Terry, I'd just like to welcome you, Terry. Hi there.
Yeah, thank you, Craig. Thanks so much for doing this. And I'm excited to meet your students. Your work is deep and direct and clear, and I think the people who are attracted are the kind of people who are serious about their own awakening and consciousness and will be serious in all the ways my book is focused on. So it's a real privilege and a delight. I feel this is an extension of the tribe that I'm at home in.
Yeah, absolutely. Well, great you're taking the time to do this. So for those of you who don't know Terry, he is a philosopher, he's an author, he's an activist, social entrepreneur, a consultant, a coach. He's someone who is kind of unique in his breadth. I mean, you know, obviously I'm a spiritual teacher and I think a lot about the world and how to change it, but Terry's someone who is a spiritual teacher, and he's also a really passionate activist, and he is also really deep in his philosophical thinking. So he brings a lot of streams together, and that's one of his gifts, is his ability to synthesize and bring a lot of points of view into perspective. You may have read a book he wrote along with Ken Wilber and some other folks a few years ago called Integral Life Practice. It's really been a sort of Bible for a new way of approaching spiritual practice, a new holistic or integral way of approaching spiritual practice and life practice as a whole. And so he's well known for that. He's also pretty well known for his webcast that he has done for many years called Beyond Awakening. It's had over 100 public conversations with some of the world's most prominent and dynamic thought leaders. And he also teaches a course called Integral Spiritual Practice through our organization, Evolving Wisdom, and has taught several other online courses as well. And of course, what we're in, I guess maybe just to share a little more about Terry, because I don't know how much you know of him. He's also a very deep spiritual practitioner with a long, many decades long background of intensive spiritual practice. He was a close student of Adi Da for a long time. And anyway, Terry's done a lot, and he's bringing all of it together in this new book, A New Republic of the Heart, which is a book that focuses on the inner work we need to do to really be, I guess I would say, ready and able to meet the challenges of our unique moment in history. And Terry's going to tell us all about that here today on this event. I suppose the last thing I would just like to say about Terry is just that he really is a very close friend of mine. He and I have co-taught courses together and had many hours of great dialogue together, and also go on hikes together and do adventures together. And so he's a real soul brother to me, and I'm very excited to be participating in bringing this book to the world that the world so urgently needs. So with that said, I'm going to go ahead and kind of just tee up our conversation briefly, which is you know, Terry, this is a very significant book, and I feel I think it's interesting for all of us as spiritual practitioners, because I know that's the people who I've invited to this are all people who are interested in spiritual awakening, hopefully interested in planetary awakening and planetary transformation as well. But I'm not going to assume that everyone is, because some of us are really just focused on our own awakening and our own transformation. And what I feel you're doing in this book is kind of a wake-up call. But not in, you know, a lot of us are, you know, in the business of giving wake-up calls, myself included, and a lot of us, you know, have had a lot of wake-up calls in our life. But I feel what's unique about your book is that you're not providing kind of a simple formula or what you think is like the simple and easy answer or the one thing that we all need to do to, you know, get it right with the world or to get it right with our spirituality. I feel like what you're doing with this book is really stepping back and saying, hey, all of us, let's wake up and pay attention. We are in a unique moment in history, and in some good ways and some bad ways, and that there are things happening in this world at a scale that have never happened before in a very negative way that put all of us in a precarious position from the climate to many other things. And at the same time, we're in a moment of unprecedented opportunity where, you know, we've got technological innovation and we have like interconnectivity around the world. So there's a chance for us to mobilize our collective will. So, you know, I find in your book, you're weaving me back and forth between like great hope and then kind of great concern and back again and, you know, really trying to get us all connected to the big picture of our moment. So I guess just to start off, I would just ask you, maybe in whatever way you want to lead us in, just, you know, what's your message to the spiritual community, the community of people who've dedicated themselves to waking up and growing up spiritually? You know, what is it that, you know, when you look around at this world of spiritual practitioners, what is it that we're not seeing, or what is it that you're trying to get us to wake up to and pay attention to that maybe we are not fully engaging with?
Great question. Great way to begin. Well, you know, the first thing that I probably need to say to communities of spiritual practitioners is I'm one of you. I have dedicated so much of my life to serious practice and awakening. And the fruits of serious practice are a radical acceptance of what is. You know, whatever is cannot, by definition, be a problem. The more fully awake we are as this present moment, the more utterly given over we are to a trust of being, a kind of radical okayness, and that okayness is the ground of depth and awakening and sanity. And so I'm in, you know, kind of radical agreement with the quality of inner freedom that is the fruits of spiritual awakening. And we're awakening into the paradoxical coincidence of the relative and the absolute. The absolute changeless nature of existence is the source of our well-being. And the relative changing qualities of circumstance are the places where we have an opportunity on the basis of our awakening to live a life of meaning and purpose, to love, to give our gifts to the world, to be an example of our own values. But it's also the place where we have to experience sickness and old age and death. It's the place where we recognize that there's this paradoxical relationship between the absolute and the relative. In deep meditation on my cushion in my meditation hall. My consciousness includes the whole world. But if a mudslide swamps my meditation hall, I'm suddenly covered in mud, and maybe I'm drowned, maybe I'm even killed. And so the relative trumps the absolute just as surely as the absolute trumps the relative. And we're all living in a moment in human history in which the complexity and the complexification, the accelerating complexification, you might say the fragmentation of human civilization is reaching a kind of critical mass. We're either in a tipping point or approaching a tipping point. And by tipping point, I mean the moment in time when things up until a certain moment were one way, and then at another moment they are suddenly really different. And if we look at the fossil record, the whole history of biological evolution is one of punctuated equilibrium. Things are roughly kind of the same for a long time, and then in a very short period of time, there's all kinds of rapid changes in the morphology of all the plants and animals, and you have a whole different ecosystem relatively quickly. Well, we're in that time. We're living in the time of the sixth great extinction biologically. Global warming is more serious than most of us have probably taken in. It's kind of depressing, but if you really examine the measurements and data in detail, which I have done in the process of researching my book, the actual data is tracking far worse than the worst case scenarios that were expected. The people who know the most about climate science are the most alarmed. Mm-hmm. And the implications of, really, it's not just global warming, it's the overshooting of the carrying capacity of the planet. We're actually degrading the living Earth at this point in a way that's reducing its ability to support people in the future. So it's very likely that big chunks of, you know, whole areas are going to be desertified. There are going to be people who will be fleeing those areas. There will be rising sea levels. There's a whole variety of things that climate science predicts that in turn create really profound follow-on effects of wildfires and killer heat waves, droughts and floods and all the rest, the extreme weather events. But then that creates uninsurable losses and impacts on the financial system and political instability when there are these flows. That's the bad news. But at the same time, we do not know, cannot fully imagine the profundity of the implications of some of our technological advances that are likely to happen in the time ahead. Not just the things that we can predict, like advances in artificial intelligence, but entirely amazing, unpredictable things that might create free energy that doesn't require the burning of fossil fuels. Maybe we'll even develop ways eventually to capture carbon from the atmosphere. The future is going to be very, very different from the past in both good and bad ways. And each of those good and bad ways are disruptive events that will change things. So what we know is the future won't be like the past and the present. How exactly it will be different, that we don't know. And yet it's clear that these problems, as Einstein is famously quoted in saying, you know, will not be able to be addressed with the kind of consciousness that created them. And by awakening, we're opening up our capacity to have a kind of freshness and openness and flexibility of awareness that can rise to meet challenges way beyond what people can conventionally imagine. So our awakening was partly motivated in many of our cases by a sense, yeah, if I'm living in a world that's changing so rapidly, I want to become someone who can be the change that's needed. And our awakening does, to some degree, prepare us. But most of us haven't connected the dots and really allowed ourselves to recognize that the more awake we are, the more responsibility we inherit for the world around us. It becomes important for there to be true human adults when things get hairy. And the more awake we are, the more we become the people who inherit that responsibility to be that presence of maturity in trying times.
So I have a concrete, that's all great context, and I have a concrete question here that I hope we'll all be able to find ourselves in this spectrum somewhere. So you know, you just described, you know, very articulately that some of, and I know it's just a small bit of, the complexity of our time and the kind of great transition we're in that we don't, you know, which we don't know where it's going to end up or, you know, where we're going to be next, but that wherever it is, we're going to be there soon and it's going to be wildly different. And you've talked about how spirituality can prepare us for that. But I want to talk about a few different responses that I know a lot of us have. So, you know, I know that everyone listening today is probably pretty in touch with a lot of the things that you mentioned. You know, we're alarmed at when we read, you know, when we read the news story that comes out that says all the scientists are, you know, much more concerned than they were a few years ago and are again issuing a warning to humanity about what's happening ecologically and particularly with climate change. We read that and we look at so many other issues facing the world and some of the economic complexities and, you know, doomsday scenarios that are predicted and, you know, running out of fossil fuel resources before we've really scaled up our renewable resources to meet our demands and what could happen. You know, so all these things, we read these things, we come across them. Some of us probably focus on them a lot. Others of us just occasionally read them when they make a big headline or something. But, you know, I know there's one response that, you know, certain people is like, forget about my spiritual practice. I need to get out and do something. But it sort of seems like there's just so much to do, and how could I even have an impact? And, you know, the scale at which these problems seem to exist is really, how does little me have a meaningful impact? You know, isn't what my work going to be just a little tiny drop in the ocean? You know, so there can be that kind of response. I know a lot of people feel a little helpless when they focus on this too much.
Definitely.
And then there's another response where we kind of say, well, I don't really know what I can do other than be a good conscious person and make good choices and, you know, vote my conscience and, you know, reduce my own carbon footprint and, you know, just be a good conscious citizen. But really what the world needs is for people to spiritually awaken. We all need to make an evolutionary leap, and so I'm going to put my energies into transformation, and that's where I'm going to pour the bulk of my energy, and then try to just live a good, decent life, and you know, support the movement of the good in the world, and you know, and then I know then there are some people who kind of say, you know, spiritually kind of think things like, well, who am I to say that what's happening in the world is, you know, is bad. You know, maybe it's going to usher in a golden new age, you know, if we go through and grapple with the crises at hand. And who might even say they're crises, and you know, there's that end of the spectrum. So, you know, I'm sure some of us are in various parts of this spectrum. You know, but I feel you're calling for something beyond, in some way beyond any of those sort of three poles I mentioned. You know, there's a spiritual maturity. You've used the term evolutionary activism. What's the essence of that, and how is it different from what I just described? How is it different from any one of those?
Well, in some sense, it's an evolution of all of them. You know, all those instincts appear in every one of us. I mean, there are moments when, in passing moods, you know, we've all felt all the things you just described, and they're part of the collective experience that we all have, for sure. I think that the biggest single thing that might differentiate what I'm offering is an argument that our recognition of just how precarious our moment is, how big the changes are that are upon us, can draw us to recontextualize our lives. And instead of being middle-class citizens of wealthy Western democracies who have a kind of conventional involvement, we support ourselves with our jobs or our savings in the context of this socioeconomic kind of setting, so that we're like middle-class citizens of our nation, that we step over a threshold into becoming citizens of what I'm calling a new republic of the heart, that this unaccountable transformation really locates us in a responsibility to be present in that new reality. And from that place, our practice is not just spiritual, it's subjective inside our own consciousness. It's also got to express itself in activism. Now, I define activism pretty broadly. I do think that everybody has a responsibility to vote and to participate in the political system, particularly now. But there are all kinds of activism. If you educate girls in the third world, or if you develop fossil fuel alternatives, you can change the world radically without having seemingly been an activist. So I think you can go in the system, against the system with protests, or go around the system altogether to just do good work in the world. But it's not just awakening and activism that we're called to. It's community. I think that our sanghas, in-person sanghas and virtual sanghas, are a place where we can become something different. That when you and I drop together in this kind of tender, disarmed, almost awed relationship to the collective mortality that our circumstance presses upon us, and the tenderness of that draws us into a different kind of intimacy. And I look at this challenge like a koan, like an impossible question, Zen riddle. What is the sound of one hand clapping? There's just no obvious answer to that. Show me your original face, the one you had before your parents were born. How do you do that? Be the change that's needed in this time, in the midst of this complexity and confusion. Be that which would re-knit the fabric of American society when we're so polarized. How would we do that? There are impossible questions that are confronting us at every turn. And we don't tend to actually accept that assignment. Dogen, who brought koan practice to Japan, wrote a kind of inscrutable essay called Genjo Koan, the meaning of which is that if you really understand koan practice profoundly, you recognize that life is confronting you with koans all the time. And we are. We're confronted with this together. But this koan wasn't given to you or to me. It was given to us. And if we drop into this profundity of this koan together, it is a kind of impossible pressure that presses us toward a different quality of relationship with each other and a different quality of adulthood. So I think that the relationships among people who are awakening are going to be a very important front line in this evolutionary pressure that is enabling us to birth the next stage of human maturity. I think it's a revolutionary change that's required of us, but looked at in terms of stage theory, it's the next stage. It's a stage transition, but a stage transition is a big deal, and I think we need to kind of redeem the archetype of the revolutionary. Something in me has needed to take a stand, to step over a threshold into that new republic of the heart and say, I'm not willing to accept these old definitions and conventions. And I, myself, the author of the book, am growing in my capacity to really occupy and radiate and transmit the gravitas and depth and resonance of that existential stand. And in fact, to do it fully, I'll need to be more deeply surrounded by other people who are doing it. It becomes something that only we can do. No individual can do on their own. But that recognition draws us into a different relationship to it. We're not just individuals. This isn't just posed to us as individuals. And therefore, we, in a way, become not arrogantly, but actually very, very with real humility, we become catalysts for transformation of all our relationships. And the urgency that we be a presence of love that makes a difference, love that is more powerful than anger, that really heightens too. I don't know if you feel that this is an adequate answer to your question. I'll be happy to pursue it further, but that at least gets going into the territory.
Sure. Well, no, I like what you're saying. And what I'm appreciating about the perspective you're bringing is the kind of feel like there's a quality of spiritual maturity in it, which means, like you're not jumping quickly to one conclusion or the other, to one particular expression of all this over another. Because I was kind of curious if you your idea of evolutionary activism was like, a certain kind of way of engaging the world. And you kind of went past it. You said, well, it could be any of a number of ways that we can be an activist, some of which you wouldn't even traditionally think of as an activist. It's just being, I almost feel like you just want to say being active, being actively engaged in the process of transforming this. But then, the other piece I'm really hearing in what you're saying is not assuming that we're seeing the whole picture, or not assuming we're even seeing the picture adequately enough that we can kind of take for granted that our response is enough. Because, I think, we know human nature, and as human beings, we see a problem, we want to, we'll spend a little time opening to the complexity of it, but, before too long, we want to kind of go, okay, I get what the problem is, and here's the real problem. The problem underneath the problem is this problem, and now that I've got a good diagnosis, I'm going to come up with my response, and then I get to feel the relief of knowing that I'm doing the best I can with this problem. And I think all of us would kind of like, those of us who want to do something about what's going on in the world, would kind of want to feel like, okay, I know the best thing I can do is this, and I'm doing it really wholeheartedly, so now I can, sleep well at night and, feel good about my life choices, and, I'm there. And I feel you're calling, there's just a nice way you're calling us beyond all of that to just say, well, this thing's really thorny. This is complex. This is a, what they call a wicked problem. You talk about that in your book, it's a wicked problem because it's such a complex problem, and it gets more complex by the moment. And it seems like when we pick it up, we make it even more complex. So, so we've got to stay very humble, but not humble in a way where we then back off from engaging and acting. So, because sometimes we get too humble. It's like, well, what do I know? I don't know how I could help, so I'm going to wait until I know. And you're saying, no, we don't have the luxury to wait until we know, because the time is now, and our actions are needed, and especially as awakening people who care and are cultivating and developing our consciousness and stepping out of the habits of the past and out of our egoic reactivity and into a more enlightened way of living. Like, we need to be doing that, but then from there, with our higher capacities, we need to lean into this, very complex, thorny wickedness of our situation, and then So, and tell me if this is what you mean. And then see what responses are called forth from there and have the courage and the heart to really engage those responses to the world, knowing that action is a given, you know, that we have to participate. But
we have to participate. Yeah. The ways we participate will be imperfect. The kinds of participation that we have done traditionally have been too naive and simple. They've simplified the challenges, and there are so many systemic causes of
give me an example of that when you say the kind, or a few examples when you say the kinds of responses we've tended to have, just so we can all see.
It's extremely important that we be politically engaged and that we elect better candidates, and there's no question that that's important. But many people just reduce everything to participation at a political level. Mm. And the terms in which the public conversation about politics is taking place dumbs us all down and draws us into a superficial level of our minds and consciousness that actually profanes the fullness of it. We have to redeem discourse. We have to actually have different kinds of conversations. One of the themes of the book, as you know, are that there are some particular conversations between people who have some measure of awakening and activists, conversations between people who are rational modernists, the kind of people who are creating the future, like Elon Musk or Nick Bostrom or Bill Gates or Sam Harris, very rational and literal in their point of view, and ecologists, people like, you know, these people are less famous, but people like Bill McKibben or Joanna Macy or our friend Lawrence Wallersheim, people who are crying, who are sounding the cry that we're already facing massive death and destruction and extinction on a scale that's really unprecedented, and forcing people to look at that. There's a kind of the innovators are much more sympathetic to a kind of transhumanist, let's colonize Mars kind of approach to the future that really is ungrounded. And then there are people like us, evolutionaries, who make our own perspective-taking object. We look at the lens through which we're looking at the world, and we awaken, and therefore are in touch with that which never changes, and in touch with the animating energetics of the world and the myths that we live out unconsciously, and are able to make conscious choices in relation to that. So we're in a position to convene those kinds of conversations. There are also really important conversations going on among women and conversations going on among men. Culture is going to be tested in the time ahead in a way that these superficial levels of conversation that don't bring out our wisdom are just going to be inadequate. And if we haven't pioneered levels of a kind of vulnerable, tender engagement that's not just a disembodied intellect analyzing something as if the world were only objective, which is capable of feeling but doesn't reduce it to poetry and moments of feeling a good feeling of being touched, as if that's the conclusion. We're being forced into a conversation that will never end. It's an endless conversation in a sense, in that it is going to be the means by which we remake culture, in which we forge a different way of being brothers and sisters in this amazing, awesome moment. And that process is partly going to express itself in these marvelous evolutionary activist projects. I described four in particular in the book in one place that are just multidimensional, where you bring in very diverse stakeholders, organizations, governments, individuals, and you just need a developed person who can speak these multiple languages and draw together a multidimensional approach to a complex problem. And we're going to need a lot of that kind of evolutionary activism. But it's not as though that approach is a skeleton key which will solve everything and put a period at the end of the sentence. We're going to have to abide in that open, qu- question, and like Rilke says, living the questions, loving the questions, letting the questions transform us together. That relationship to the questions, it's just different. It's a shared inquiry. Like the kinds of conversations that go on cable news, people who think they already know and who have opinions, exchanging their certainties, and all those certainties are false, even the best of them. For people to bring their uncertainty and their curiosity to one another and really listen and be changed by the way the wisdom or insight of the other strikes them, and then to venture into new territory, that's what we need. We need discourse that actually evolves our knowledge and presses it into new territory. That is so exciting. And that is a different relationship between us.
Now you just brought up something that I know is, again, on a lot of our minds, and it's something that I think many of us today find very vexing or, you know, very challenging about you know, any talk about radical change, which is, you know, you talked about cable news and the kind of conversations that are going on. And, you know, I guess what I want to talk about is the culture war that seems to be going on. And particularly the one, you know, I know there's a broader culture war between sort of, you know, tribal. Anyway, let me not go into that too far. I'm talking about the culture war, like, in our country here in the United States, where we – so I can see for a lot of us, we could think, yeah, okay, I want to be a convener of higher-order conversations and dialogue, and I want to be in those discussions. And when we think about the people that we can imagine being in those conversations with, they probably mostly feel like people who think a lot like we do. Like, I can imagine being in those conversations with you, Terry, and a lot of the names that you mentioned who are, you know, very progressive, you know, thinkers, even though, you know, from different camps, obviously, you mentioned, but still kind of broadly progressive-minded individuals. And then, you know, we should all have these conversations, and that feels important, and I feel you're really sponsoring that, saying, look, those of us who, you know, can come together, really need to, and we need to stretch across, you know, and talk to people from other points of view. But again, the people who are going to maybe seem like willing to engage in a conversation like you're talking about, engaging our uncertainties, it feels like a certain group. And then we turn and we think, yeah, but when I look around me in this country, I feel like there's this whole, you know, very large group of people who I can't relate to at all and who seem, you know, they elected our current administration, which seems to be running roughshod over all the progress of the last several decades on so many levels. And there's a, you know, and I'm sharing this country and this planet with a lot of people who seem not just to be like a little different in their point of view, but seem radically different in their point of view and to not care about the damage that's being done to the environment or, you know, like just recently all the banking regulations that were rolled back just, you know, a day ago or 2 days ago,
yeah.
You know, et cetera, you know, and it's like, wow, there's a, well, these folks, you know, I can't imagine how I'm going to come together across that divide, and I'm bringing it up because in many ways it feels like unless we can do that, we can't really advance anything, you know, on a political level, or, you know, it just gets, we make all these advances and then there's a regime change and they all get thrown out the window and, you know, we just went back a decade. And so, and I'm not saying your book's about this per se or anything else, but I feel you're bringing a very enlightened, thoughtful, integral perspective to the wholeness of our moment, and this is a big part of our experience right now is, God, how do we get out of this push-pull between what seem like two completely almost different species of people? So,
yes, it's true, very true, and it's particularly vexing. This is a conversation that we could pursue for hours because there's so many nooks and crannies and nuances to the dynamics. But there are a couple of things that I can offer. One is, it's very important, I think, to reach out to our relatives and neighbors and reassert our human connections across those tribal lines. And do that in a way that isn't wimpy, but that really inquires into what the qualities of those bonds are. Sometimes it seems as though people on the right really want to stockpile a bunch of guns and come kill us, sweet liberal people. And that, just the human connectedness and the quality of our just mutual respect and conversation is a simple thing we can do all the time. The second thing, though, is we actually need to win the next round. It's important to be politically engaged, to not necessarily to listen to a lot of news or watch a lot of news, whatever, you know, read a lot of news, but to vote, perhaps to make political donations, to volunteer, to engage, because we can't take it for granted that we're going to continue to live in an open liberal democracy over time anymore. And so this is a time when that in-the-system activism is actually a responsibility, and I don't think all spiritual practitioners quite recognize that. However, for us to be active requires us to wade into the culture wars that are there within the broad mass of right-thinking people that are not part of the current kind of abomination of the Trump presidency, the divisiveness that's being brought from the Republican side. On the Democratic side, there are very different people, like I was describing, these modernist innovators and spiritual practitioners and left activists, the Bernie supporters who oppose the corporate Democrats and so forth. We have culture wars on the left that tend to divide us. And we also have a lot of people on the left who fall into conspiracy thinking in ways that are extreme, and yet there are ways that the mainstream narrative is incomplete, and there are reasons to think more deeply and not necessarily accept the view, the worldview that's communicated in the mainstream media. So we have some work to do with speaking across divisions between worldviews, just among people that are essentially world-centric. World-centric meaning post-Enlightenment. There's a kind of regression going on the right in which it's kind of a tribal, let's conform to traditional values for God and country and unite our tribe for our dominance of the political future for our country. And that's what Trump is exploiting in, I think, a pretty cynical and selfish way. But on the left, we're going to have to restore truth. We're tending to live in a post-truth world, and that means we're going to have to unite around Enlightenment values. The points of view of the new atheists and the we might see in Sam Harris's writings. He's a very popular person who's very much a modernist, a rationalist, that we're all probably at least slightly familiar with. That restoration of Enlightenment values so that we're not in a post-truth world in which everybody's got their own theory. We have to restore the practice of journalism, the respect for science, the basics of having a truth-informed public discourse that can guide our collective decision-making. And so the most revolutionary, I'm ultimately a revolutionary. I don't agree with Sam Harris. I'm ultimately interested in a spiritual transformation of culture. But in this next cycle, I have to look ahead at the political future with a view that includes gosh, at least 5 or 6 election cycles. And the first thing we have to do right now is to prevent a kind of cultural regression and a degeneration of our public discourse so that the he said, she said that we're seeing from people like Kellyanne Conway is actually delegitimized. And the only way we can do that is to unite with all rational people for the next cycle. And that kind of thinking is, it's quite nuanced and complex. I mean, to really unpack it, we'd need to take more time. But I hope you get the essential gist.
Well, I really like that last statement you just made, to unite with all rational people for the next cycle. Like that feels grounding and sane and, you know, potentially doable. Yeah, and so anyway, I like everything you said. And I kind of want to just bring us back to, you know, the sort of descriptive line for your book is a guide to inner work for holistic change. And here we are within a spirit context of a spiritual community having this conversation. So what's the inner work for holistic change that you're specifically pointing to? And how is it different, or what's the nuance that makes it, you know, there's a lot of different kinds of inner work that we can do. And those of us tuning into this audio have no doubt done a lot of it in a lot, many different kinds. And, you know, we can do psychological healing work. We can do shadow work. You know, we can do various other kind, you know, cognitive behavioral therapy. We can do meditation. We can do evolutionary life practices like I teach, or integral life practices like you teach, many other things. But it seems that at least what you're pointing to, is it a particular kind of inner work, or is it just a recontextualization of all those different kinds of inner work I just mentioned? You know, what makes it inner work that's really revolutionary in nature, or, you know, making us adequate to the challenge of our moment?
Uh-huh. Yeah. Actually, I want to answer that question, but I want to start with something a little preliminary,
sure.
Which is to say, I think that the inner work and the way I describe the inner work in the book is truly integral, and an integral approach to that inner work means that we can't reduce it to one thing. Very often, spiritual teachings point to the highest realization, the highest non-dual realization, for example, as if that then is the point. But even somebody with the highest non-dual realization, who has a life, relationships, and maybe responsibilities for an institution, is going to need to master some other things having to do with leadership and communication and commitment and a whole variety of other curricula in the school of life. And so the humility with which we recognize the full 360-degree scope of how we can mature. This school of life has this profoundly integral curriculum, and it requires ultimately, you know, everything of us. And so the humility that can prioritize and value these different kinds of practice simultaneously and not reductively choose one and decide that it's the be-all and the end-all, that's the important disposition that we need to bring. And then the inner work also then begins to include a kind of social inner work, like an inner work that has to express itself in our ways of relating to others. There are, and not just our ways of relating to others, but our sanghas themselves can practice. Thich Nhat Hanh famously said, "The next Buddha may be a sangha." You know, I think that we're looking at a cultural transformation, a whole system change that's far more fundamental than the ending of British colonialism in India, like Gandhi helped organize. You know, it's bigger than the civil rights movement that Dr. King, you know, that organized itself around the great figure of Dr. King, or Nelson Mandela and his role in South Africa and the ending of apartheid. This is bigger by far. and it could never organize itself around a single person. But it, you know, this next Buddha that might be a Sangha, a network of Sanghas, a Metta Sangha, a whole series of practicing communities which take a profound stand for being a spiritual presence in the midst of disruption. The disruption is a two-sided thing. It opens a window of opportunity for more fundamental systems redesign. And the stronger our communities of practice are, the more capable we are of being there for one another under challenging circumstances, the more awake and transparent and lucid and truly loving we're able to be, the more resilient our sanghas are going to be and the more moral authority they'll have in the choices that are made during times of disruption if we have to go through them, when we have to go through them. And so those are clues to pieces of what this inner work is like. I personally, I feel the kind of awakening that you're teaching is absolutely essential, because without that fundamental awakening, we're just not dislodged from a fundamentally egoic motive. Not just the suffering of the egoic motive, but the ways in which the ego is just utterly untrustworthy. The ego is a selfish, sneaky son of a gun, you know. That there is no basis for trusting another person if that's really their motivational structure. And to the degree that we really awaken and know ourselves as something far beyond our own personal position, then the beginnings of a kind of altruism are authentic in us. And our sanghas need to become a locus where within the group we can be genuinely there for each other, altruistic in a real way, genuinely active as love in our relations. And that then recruits and demands us to cultivate our qualities of leadership, qualities of, partly just, you know, lightheartedness. One of the things I didn't emphasize is that this confrontation with the seriousness of our situation tends to be such a bummer that it it draws us into a humorless relationship to experience. And a crucial aspect of our practice is to restore humor in the fullest possible way and draw ourselves together into a kind of unreasonable happiness that allows us to be a presence of love no matter what, and a presence of humor with little spring in our step and sass and playfulness. And how can, you know, things are far too serious. We need to be at our best. So that sense of humor becomes crucial.
Thank you. And so I know that we only have a little bit more time left. And one thing I think would help bring this all down to earth for all of us would maybe just to hear a little bit from you personally about, you know, as you shared at the beginning that, you know, this, you had to take a stand, you know, and bringing forth this book is part of your stand, that, you know, it's not enough to just, you know, focus on your inner work, but you really need to bring the inner and the outer work together and, you know, be planting your stake in, I'm going to do everything I can to cause a better future. And, you know, this sounds like a kind of, even though I know all of this has been living in you for a long time, it sounds like this is, you know, bringing forth this book, this statement is a bit of a new moment. So how does everything you've been describing really live in you right now? So, like, as you hold the complexity of our moment and you look at what it is to be an activist, like, give us just the sort of on the ground look at Terry as an evolutionary activist, a deep spiritual practitioner, but someone who's also really trying to bridge the inner and outer, engage in the collective work. Like, give us a little bit of a snapshot of, yeah, what you're doing and how all this is expressing itself through you, because I know that's just a process and you're at a certain moment in time with the process, that and would just love to the flesh.
Well, you know, Craig, that's such a moving target. I'll say this, that I used to feel I feel like I've inherited responsibility for the future in a way, and in another way, I feel like everything is lightened up too.
Mm.
It's as if there's a kind of radical commitment that is forcing me to be wide open to life being entirely different than it's been in the past, and I'm sort of childlike in a whole new way. It's taken me into a whole different place. I'm much more permeable in certain ways, and yet much more lit up. I'm kind of on fire at the same time. There's a surge of energy that sometimes runs through me that, you know, I'm by personality type, I'm a pretty soft and receptive and gentle person. But sometimes I'll be seized by a kind of, you know, like a Jehovah kind of prophetic kind of energy where I'm just sort of roaring with a, this must be, you know, that I refuse to let you be separate from me. We're in this lifeboat together. I'm not going to abandon you, and I will not accept your abandonment of me. This must be. There's a kind of force that seizes me at times. And yet at other times I feel kind of like a just beginner's mind, just wide open. It's been a dizzying time. The book's only been out for a little over a week, and this transition from having been pregnant with this baby for so long, giving birth to this elephant, so to speak, to being in a world in which it's now outside my body, so to speak. I'm kind of blinking my eyes in a whole new world, like a newborn baby myself.
Hmm. That's nice. It's a nice image. Well, I want to share with you how I'm letting this book impact me, and letting your words here impact me. So, you know, I'm a very passionate evolutionary. I'm, you know, dedicated my life to helping people awaken to who they really are, and also awaken to the impulse of evolution, and really allow that to animate our lives. And, you know, I'm on the, you know, in the terms of the spectrum that maybe we've been looking at, you know, clearly my focus is, you know, largely on inner work and rooted in the belief that until consciousness evolves, until some of us are willing to, you know, be the guinea pigs, or be the ones to step out of the old momentum of our human nature and into giving birth to a new kind of human nature, and I feel it in my bones that nothing could be more important than that work, because unless that's happening, you know, we're still the same kind of unconscious, conditioned animals trying to solve these very vexing problems, and we're not going to really break out. So I feel very obviously filled with passion and confidence about the work I'm doing, and, you know, I'm impacting tens of thousands of people, you know, with this work, if not hundreds of thousands more broadly. And, you know, there's a way I can feel fully actualized in my life, like real often, right? I'm just doing this, and I'm all in with it, and it consumes all my time and energy. And, you know, I might have thoughts like, oh, gee, maybe I should, you know, go be more politically active. I should use my platform to be more politically active. But I'll come off that, and I'll come back to, you know, I need to keep my focus where it is, because that's where I can do the most good. So I'm saying that's my kind of default at this point in my life generally. But what I'm letting your book push on me is to push me, you know, just a little off center of that, to like not assume that I'm doing enough, and to lean in more, just more, a little more aggressively into, okay, what else could I do that would maybe be outside the whole world of everything I'm doing to help move some of these things forward that are very concrete right now, you know, that we've spoken about here, Mm-hmm. And, you know, how could I help move the dial on that in ways that maybe aren't just me doing my spiritual teaching work? And not that I would turn away from that in any way, but just to not feel like, so I'm trying to say is to not let myself feel comfortable or too comfortable in the sense of like I'm doing my all, but to kind of say, well, our situation as a human species, as a human race right now and as a planet doesn't afford any of us the luxury to be too comfortable, you know, no matter how much we're doing and no matter how much impact we're having. You know, maybe there's always a more, and let me be challenged by that, by the truth of that, and lean into some of these things and let them call forth new responses from me that I don't even know yet. And to just be open to that, to be vulnerable to that, to let myself be challenged. And so I want to thank you for that nudge that your book is in that way, and that you have been in this conversation, and for really pouring your heart and soul into bringing this forth as a real, really meaningful contribution to the conversation that we're all in right now. So,
yeah, thank you. You know, it just delights me to hear you say that, because that summary is exactly what I would hope, that we live in that gap, that we let that koan draw something new out of us. And the relationship we have as friends is not one where I want to tell you what to do. I want to be with you in that shared inquiry, and you've just described how you're there with me, and that just makes me love you all the more. It's a beautiful, beautiful way to complete it.
All right. Oh, love you too, brother. So, well, I guess to bring this to a close, I want to encourage any of you who felt touched, challenged, inspired, intrigued by this conversation to go out and buy Terry's book and take the deep dive into it. There, you know, you got what you got here in this hour that we've of conversation is just the tiniest little tip of a very big iceberg that this book represents. It's full of very interesting perspectives, facts, just even information about things that are happening right now that many of us might not be aware of, because there's so much happening. It's hard to stay in touch with it all, and I feel Terry's really synthesized in just an enormous amount of scholarship and wisdom. And so I encourage you to give it a deep read, take it in, and see where it leads you, see what it calls you to do from that deep place that Terry invited us into today. So to do that, where should they go, Terry?
Well, you can come to terrypatton.com or newrepublicoftheheart.com. They're two different portals to the same website. And at newrepublicoftheheart.com, you can download a free excerpt from the book or a MP3 of me reading that excerpt. And there are links to Amazon and Barnes & Noble and your independent booksellers so that you could order the book directly there. So I'd invite you to do all that.
Yeah, good. So newrepublicoftheheart.com or terrypatton.com. And I encourage you to take a deeper dive. Great. Well, thanks again, Terry. Always lovely
Thank
to
you
be
so
with
much,
you.
Craig.
And thanks both for your...
And thanks, everybody.
Yeah. I was just going to say thanks, you know, both for your passionate commitment to all this and living a life that expresses everything you shared, and also your willingness to work really hard to bring it forth in a book, because I know this book was a heroic effort for you, and it shows in the reading. It's a great read.
Thank you.
All right. Okay. Well, take care. Thanks for tuning
so
in.
So long,
everyone.
Craig.
Much love.
Yeah.
Okay.
Thanks, everybody. Bye-bye. Okay.